when you experience the plane of reality where everything is interdependent, it includes you. You're part of it all. If you flip the dial and go to another plane of reality, you see that behind all of the forms, which are like cloud patterns, there's only one of it. There's one stuff. There's one stuff that keeps going into these incredible patterns, which are mainly space, by the way.
Welcome to the Ram Dass Here and Now podcast. This is episode 248, Patterns of Interdependency. I'm Jackie Dobrinska, and you are this web of people from around the world. You are this Ram Dass community, whether this is your first episode or your 248th. Thank you for tuning in. So this talk is from a 1992 lecture in Edgerton, Massachusetts. So keep in mind, this is 30 years ago. And I'm kind of amazed that it's from the archives because it seems as if Ram Dass is reaching out through time and space to talk directly to us about what is happening in the world today. So the first half is admittedly a bit of a check. He's asking us to face things. Ram Dass discusses our looming ecological crisis, politics, and greed. And he goes on to elucidate the causes of fundamentalism, ethnic prejudices, economic polarization, and nationalism. And then he talks about how our karmas here in the first world are tied to those, even in small remote islands that we've never heard of, and all of the people that live there, people we may have never met, but are still deeply connected to. But he doesn't leave us in this downer of it all for long, typical of Ram Dass, right? While suffering is a part of the fabric of the human race at this time, the solutions to these problems are within us. So he shares that wonderful Terry Dobson story that we actually heard recently, telling us how we can practice Aikido in action as we renew ourselves once again every day to face the heartbreaks of the world. He gives us instructions for riding the waves of Kali Yuga, which if you don't know that term, he explains in the lecture. But if you know anything about Ram Dass, you know that it has something to do with the heart. And then he tells us how to embrace the paradox of living on different planes of reality at the same time or moving between them and the importance of doing so. I'm sure he says many more things that you'll catch. But one thing that also stood out was this reminder that miracles are not far-fetched. So to quote his very dear old friend, Jack Kornfield, no amount of new technology, computers and internet, space technology, nanotechnology, or biotechnology will stop continuing warfare and racism and environmental destruction. The powers of science and technology now have to be matched by the inner developments of humanity. They have to be matched by the heart. It's the kind of love that has mothers lift cars off their children. It's powerful. And it's needed to plant seeds for a better present and future. And remember, we need to keep an eye on the vision of the future we want because we hit what we look at. So Jack goes on to say, you pick one thing, you come close to it, you get to know it, and then you do it with love, that this is a part of our awakening. So while on this topic of awakening and the problems and the brilliance of the world, we all probably know that psychedelics was a big part of Ram Dass's journey. And most of us know, probably, about this renaissance in the psychedelic research right now. And a lot of that conversation is about mental health. It's about the incredible benefits of psychedelics on things like PTSD and depression, attachment injury, fear of death, and so much more. And yet Ram Dass was an intersection of science and spirituality. So Love, Serve, Remember Foundation is starting a new free monthly community conversation called Inner Flight School, which was based on a name that Ram Dass wanted to give a program for helping people to work with these substances more consciously. So this is not a program. This is not a school. This is just simply a place to have conversations. And we already have an amazing lineup of speakers scheduled, starting April 25th with Bruce Damer, who is a researcher at the UC Santa Cruz Department of Biomolecular Engineering. He's also an associate of the NASA Astrobiology Center, and he developed the hot spring hypothesis for the origin of life, which is changing where they are placing the rovers on Mars right now. So his theory, it came out of a psychedelic journey, and he believes that psychedelics can be an agent for creative problem solving, needed for both our personal healing as well as our collective healing and our issues that are facing the world today. So to find out more about this group, as well as our bi-monthly Soul Pod meetups that discuss each of these episodes, as well as our affinity groups, go to ramdas.org/fellowship and sign up. So speaking of mushrooms, most mushrooms are not psychedelic, and many of them are still just as mind-bending, but in other ways. So lion's mane is this incredible mushroom that supports cognition, and it does so by preventing neural degeneration and also stimulates neural regeneration. So that is incredibly cool. And lion's mane is just one of the ingredients in Magic Mind, this incredible little drink that helps me stay focused and energized and creative throughout the day. And I love it because it's super easy to use, it tastes great, and it helps me in ways that are kind of unbelievable. So you get 50% off your subscription for the next 10 days with the code RAMDAS. Just go to magicmind.com/RAMDAS. And as always, we give thanks to all of our sponsors and donors. If you're not donating already, please do so at ramdas.org/donate, at ramdas.org/donate. It is the only way we are able to bring you these podcasts. As always, we give thanks for the great privilege to be here with each other, to listen to these lectures, and we dedicate whatever good comes from this to all beings everywhere. So, with that, here is Ram Dass, here and now. Namaste and blessings.
This is kind of a nice thing to do on a rainy evening. Sort of get together and tune to our collective intuitive heart. Feel where we are in the universe. Examine our massive denials together. I was with John Seed. He's an environmentalist from Australia. He's a very beautiful man. And he's a person that lies in front of bulldozers and chains himself to trees. And he's been very concerned about the rainforests. And I said, John, where are we in this whole thing? John said, well, at this point, from my understanding of it, in view of the inertia and the rate, it would take a miracle. I don't remember anybody saying that to me that baldly, that at this point, for us to continue to survive would take a miracle. And I was somewhat taken aback And he said, but after all, when you consider it, he said, we did come up out of the ocean onto land. You know, he says, we have not a bad lineage as far as miracles are concerned. Like, don't give up the ship just yet. But that conversation with him really started me thinking about death. I, as many of you know, work with people that are dying. And I work with an individual who's dying. And I see behind it. I see behind the dying person to another soul just like me, who's just going through a different process at the moment than I am. I'm going through what's known as aging. And soon I'll go through dying. And I feel pretty open. My heart feels very open when I'm working with such an individual. But what John Seed's expression left me with was that possibly I was bedsitting the dying of the culture in which I exist, including me, of course. And I started to reflect about just allowing that possibility. How could I live, or why would I live, or what would I live with, or what was the meaning of this part of life? Castaneda talks about keeping death on your left shoulder as you go through life. Can you all hear now? I'll get your attention with something. And in the East, it's sort of understood that people live their lives as preparation for the moment of death, because they are deeply tuned to the idea of reincarnation. And they see this life as a prelude to the next, whatever comes next. And they know that how they leave this life has an effect on what happens next. I've been reading a lot of literature from Judaism, and I found a rabbi who said, I've spent my whole life preparing for my moment of death. But as I listen to, in the political arena, for example, I hear a lot of cosmetic surgery, but I don't hear anybody looking at the universe the way it is. Looking at the bizarre economic polarization that's happening throughout the world. Looking at all the ecological imminences we're surrounded by. Looking at what it means to be, for example, in this country, the country that has the largest percentage of people in prison of any country in the world. And we're the ones that won. Isn't that far out? the quality of the air, the quality of the water, the quality of the food. And the culture goes merrily along, sort of out of the side of its mind, saying, well, technology may have gotten us into this, but it'll get us out of it. We can think our way out of this. In India, they talk about the vast stages of time, and they talk about the Kali Yuga as the Iron Age. It's the age when the Bull of Truth, which at the beginning in the purest age has all 4 feet on the ground, at the end has only 1 foot left on the ground. Can you imagine it's an age where politicians lie? Can you imagine what that must be like? Kali Yuga goes on, according to the Hindu calendar, for probably 400,000 years, so don't rush. I mean, we're probably just at the beginning. I mean, let's just say for a moment that I'm not a doomsayer. I mean, it sounds all dark and heavy, but that's all depends on where your mind is about it. It's really just interesting phenomena. Here comes life. There it goes. The streams were pure. Now they're contaminated. Groundwater contaminated, so more people get cancer. Well, changes the population. $50 to $100 million people will die of AIDS in Africa at the rate we're going. They're just HIV positive now. That doesn't mean they'll die by any means, but if nothing happens, they probably will. See, I don't think we ever sit around. Jerry Brown tried to do it, but he's a little shrill. He's sort of, you know, because he's too head trippy. He's too much of a Jesuit. But he had good intention. He wanted to say, hey, everybody, you know, it's a little worse than this. You know, everybody else was saying, I'll fix it. Don't worry. Big Daddy will take care of it. Look at all the power a presidency has. I'll fix everything. Bill Clinton has such a long list of things he'll fix. Just reading it will take him 4 years. Not only are we facing in our culture in here in this country some of the implications of our zeal of one kind or another, but we're exporting it. In fact, we're homogenizing the world around the same values. So countries that grow up, that have simple crops that serve them become one crop countries to feed the huge economic system, and they get locked into the system. And I was just in the South Pacific last winter boogie boarding. That may surprise you, but I was 60 last year and I had to take on something new to honor it. And I was in the Marquesa Islands, French Polynesia. It's where Gauguin did his last paintings and is buried. And the island is 6 miles by 9 miles. And they all look like Gauguin paintings. And there's 1,200 people on the island. 80% of them have never been off the island. And they have these big tikis of the gods they worship. But two things have changed. First of all, the past 80 years, the Catholic Church came in. And wherever there was a big tiki, they put a bigger cross up on the hill. So they have a new tiki. That's fine. The other thing that happened is about 3 years ago, television came in. And to walk into a room and look at these people who have faces that are unlined by anxiety, who are not feeling caged in by living on an island 6 miles by 9 miles, where they pick the fruit from the trees, catch the fish, eat the wild pigs, sing a lot. To watch them watching a television show about a Los Angeles police car I don't know. I feel, when I experience that, I feel sad. I feel sad. I see the inevitability of it, but I feel sad. I'm connected with an outfit called the Saver Foundation, which is an extraordinarily wonderful group of people that came together out of the sheer desire to relieve some suffering in the world. It was an intentional group coming together for that purpose. And among the different projects we have in Nepal and India and with the Native Americans and so on, we have these projects in Mexico and Guatemala with the Guatemalans. And there were three villages of refugees in Chiapas in Mexico, who were, in a way, had become like slaves to the Mexicans. They didn't have any green cards or whatever the comparable thing is in Mexico. And they lived in the cane fields in really incredibly harsh conditions. Their children all had incredible vitamin deficiency. There was one hose for 125 people. That was the whole water. And so we got very involved in helping them figure out what they could do about it, helping them to help themselves. Maimonides' highest stage of giving. And their kitchens, they lived in these mud, in these corrugated tin huts with mud floors. And when the rainy seasons came, the water would come down, and the women and babies would be living, cooking the food up to their ankles in mud through the rainy season. And so we helped them get cement, and we helped with this and that. And one of the big things was to get some electricity there. And it took a couple of years. It was hitched up, but the Mexicans wouldn't turn it on. Finally, they turned it on in two camps, but not the third. So a group of us went down to see how things were going and bring toys for the kids and just see what was happening and where we could help. Came to the first camp. It's like sunset, getting dark. They had no electricity. And they were all sort of sitting around, talking quietly. They were kind of depressed, hard conditions, but they were making do. They were people from the mountains of Guatemala They were used to hard conditions. Went to the second camp, and they had the electricity, and the lights were on, and the children were playing out in the courtyard, and there was a radio playing music, and there was animated conversation. Went to the third camp and pulled in, and there was nobody there. There was electricity. And we got out of the Jeep and we went around looking for them, came into the big meeting room, and there they all were, looking at television. Somebody had won a bicycle in a raffle and traded it for a television set. So here were these people who were these beautiful Guatemalans with an incredible Mayan tradition. And we were doing everything we could with bringing in knitting yarns so they could weave their regular fabrics, the fabrics that were they were indigenous to their culture. Bring in musical instruments and all of that to try to help them retain their culture. And there they all were, eyes glued to this television set, which was selling at that moment a soap for cream for softening the hands of women. And we walked in and they looked at us like, could you come back later? We're looking at television. Usually the changes that are occurring to us are happening so pervasively that we don't get hold of them very well. We don't even notice them. The quality of life changes, and we hardly know. We notice that our eyes tear a little more, or you cough, or when you land in Los Angeles, it's all yellow, stuff like that. But most of it, we kind of ride with. But when you get a chance to see, as I say, out of the corner of your eye, Rilke has a beautiful line, just beyond the billboard at the edge of town. You see, just behind the facade of the whole game. And you see that you can't hold on. The change, phenomena change. And what turns out to be interesting is where one stands in relation to change. I can moan and groan about the Marquesas of Guatemala or the contamination of the water. Or I can do something about it to awaken people, try to change things. How I try to do that, how I do it will determine whether I burn out almost immediately from frustration or whether I'm in for the long term. In order to be in for the long term, to be an instrument for consciousness or awakening or bringing into harmony things or being responsive to change without freaking. The usual reaction to change is if there are little changes, you become very creative and accommodating to them. But if the changes get too big and too fast, people get frightened. Like, people can handle aging pretty well, but the minute you get cancer and it's going to be quicker, you get frightened. When people get frightened, they tend to grab hold. There's an increase in fundamentalism, ultranationalism, ethnic prejudices, polarization in economics, all of which ultimately foreshadows violence. So let's say John Seed's right. And let's just say, just for speculation, because you hardly ever do, don't get depressed. We're just talking about just my psychosis. just assume the shit's really going to hit the fan. It's going to get worse. You think it's bad now, it's going to get much worse. There'll be cars on this island from one end to the other. A super highway to Edgartown, yes. Just imagine, just for a second. Then we'll all say it was a dream and it's all going to be all right. Technology will save us. But just for fun, let's imagine that it's going to really get bad. Your IRA is going to go to hell. The employment's going to go up. Violence in inner cities is going to get worse. More people won't be able to read and write. Untrammeled greed will be rewarded. The Donald Trumps of the world. I guess he's not a good model anymore. Where could you stand inside yourself? Not that you would say, well, that's all true, but who cares? I'm not talking about La La Land. Where could you stand inside yourself where you could be quiet enough to be able to look at what is and hear how to respond in an appropriate way? I really, I hadn't planned to do this because any of you that have ever heard my material know this, but it's so good I'm going to do it anyway. We're getting a whistle up here. If I can find it, I'm going to do it. If I brought it. This is a story from the book, How Can I Help?, that Paul Gorman and I wrote several years ago. And those of you that have heard it, it's okay because think of how many times I've heard it. And each time, it really is rich. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty, a few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the door opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore laborer's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer ended a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed the metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. This is written by a friend, Terry Dobson. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I've been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you're already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. Could you turn down the mic just a little bit if somebody's up there? Thank you. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even went so far as to cross the street to avoid the guys who lounged around the train stations. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized the chance to focus his rage. Aha! He roared. A foreigner. You need a lesson in Japanese manners. I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. All right, he hollered. You're going to get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, Hey! It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to my left, the drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here, the old man said in easy vernacular, beckoning to the drunk. Come here and talk with me. He waved his hand lightly. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, Why the hell should I talk to you? The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. What you been drinking? He asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. I've been drinking sake, the laborer bellowed back, and it's none of your business. Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. Oh, that's wonderful, the old man said. Absolutely wonderful. You know, I love sake, too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake, and we take it out in the garden, and we sit on an old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down, and we like to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My great-grandfather planted that tree, and we worry about whether it'll recover from the ice storms we had last winter. Our tree has done better than I expected, though, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. It's gratifying to watch when we take our sake and go out to enjoy the evening, even when it rains. He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. Yeah, he said. I love persimmons too. His voice trailed off. Yes, said the old man, smiling, and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife. No, replied the laborer. My wife died. Very gently swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself. Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. There I was, standing in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness. I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. The train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. My, my, he said, that is a difficult predicament. Sit down here and tell me about it. I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with kind words. I had just seen Aikido tried in combat, and the essence of it was love. It's interesting how when a situation awakens fear and danger, who has the equanimity to shout, "Hey, wow, look at this. Also, what do we do now?" Everybody else going, This woman, I was teaching this course a few years ago, and all the stuff I may have said before, but my mind just, I don't know what's real anymore. I just know the stories I've told. It's a real problem. I don't even know if I exist. I just remember talking about me so much. A few years ago, there was this course that I was leading in New York City at St. John the Divine. And it was a course in which all the students were invited to participate in the community around homelessness, either food kitchens or shelters or politics, political action. And then we had an open microphone. And this woman said, she said, "Every day I leave my apartment in Manhattan and I go to the corner to get the bus. And she said, for the past 8 months on the corner, there's been this man standing with a paper cup with some coins in it, jiggling the cup. She said, he's been there for 8 months. Now every day he's there when I go. And she said, I give him a little money now and then. And then she kind of gave a little sheepish smile and she said, actually, she said, he's been there so long, I've worked out a budget, $250 a week, and I just put it in now and then. She said, but as a result of taking this course, I realized that I had never acknowledged him as a human being. And she said, I realized that I was afraid. So we started to talk about what was she afraid of. She wasn't afraid she was going to be raped. She wasn't afraid her purse was going to be stolen. Finally, she said, I'm afraid that if I open my heart to him, he'll end up in my living room. Does that resonate in you at all? Does it resonate in you at all that how you deal with the stuff of the world is rooted in fear that you will lose your boundaries, that you lose the way to limit? It's like, I can't look at the suffering because it's too vast and it will overwhelm me. So I'll just look away. If you listen to that woman, what she's saying is, because if you look at the way the heart, the intuitive heart works, this expression, you know, my heart goes out to you. When you love someone, you know, when you're in love with somebody, if you're really in love, and I'm not talking about being attached to or, you know, romantic love. I'm talking about being in the space of love with another human being. Your joy is in their joy. You need something, use it. Take my car, take my credit card, take my life. Go ahead, I love you. You do what makes you happy. And our mind, which is the sort of the, it's computer central for our separateness. As incarnates, we're separate, and the prefrontal and all of the stuff up there runs it like the captain was trying to run the Queen Elizabeth II. And he's saying, the mind is constantly saying, now, wait a minute, to the heart. You can't give away everything. What about your health insurance? And it's an interesting dialogue between the mind and the heart. Because the mind is always protecting you as a separate entity. And the heart is always saying, well, you know, what boundaries? You and I are us. There's no them. we're only us in love. And I realized the woman was saying that she was afraid of the power of her own compassion. And I thought, isn't it interesting to live in a culture where you are afraid of your own compassion? And the way you do it, because there's so much that would awaken that compassionate outgoing of love and embracing of the universe, that you build these armorings. Like you take doctors that work in and nurses that work in intensive care units. They develop a certain kind of what you'd call professional warmth. They're appearing to have feelings, but the feelings are in the service of their mind because they're frightened of the power of the real feelings, or that they'd burn out if they had feelings for each situation. And I would say that in the conditions we find ourselves in, to live with that kind of armoring about the nature of suffering in the world and the nature of the possibility of the end of it all, I would say that is a dysfunctional way of living. And that the result of armoring yourself against suffering and against the unknown and against the possibility of death is something that leads you to stand up in the subway to take on the guy rather than the, hey. The hey came, you like sake, I like sake. Here we are. We guys like sake. Let me tell you about my wife. Not, there's that drunk scaring everybody. I got to do something about it. I speak at a lot of peace rallies, and it's amazing how angry the people are. You think, isn't this bizarre? I mean, if this is the best we can do, boy, we're spreading quite a, well, it's like Typhoid Mary. Have some more food, dear. But the question is, how do you keep your heart open in hell? That's what you and I are facing at this moment. How do you keep your heart open so that it just keeps breaking all the time? How do you bear the unbearable? I spend time with many people, people who have had their children murdered or die or lose their loved ones, who are in the deep process of grieving. And I say to them, I can't take away your grief. Your grief is burning its way through your loss, the pain of it all. But if you watch people over years, people that have had that deep stuff, that deep pain, that bearing the unbearable, they come at the other end, they come out with a certain kind of earthy-rooted compassion. It's like they've looked into the fire and they're still here. In India, the saints are often called the living dead, because they've died in a way, and then here they are. The interesting theoretical way to look at this is that to the extent that you sit, that your consciousness rests on one plane of reality, namely the physical, psychological, social plane, these realms, to that extent, and you are busy being a separate entity, to that extent, the situation is unbearable and you have to put up a defense mechanism of one kind or another, denial, dissociation, sublimation, something. For me, what happened through originally mushrooms and then through yoga and meditation, my guru, all the stuff, was that I started to move in and out of planes of consciousness. And I realized that there were other takes of reality other than the one that I was a conspirator in with everybody around me. All of the patterns, it's the same thing that you get when you go into quantum mechanics and physics. Go down and down. You see these incredible patterns of interdependency of all phenomena in the universe at the level of phenomena. That's a plane of reality, let's call it. And if you go into that realm of consciousness, you look and you are so awed by the incredible beauty. I mean, that's where you get a feeling of a wisdom source in the universe, or a sense of God, or a sense of evolving and opening out kind of evolutionary process. And you experience awe. And you're awed at the way the law's unfolding, and that includes all of it. It includes the suffering and the death and the joy and the creation and all of it. But if you just stay at that plane, if you could, which you can't, but probably, but if you could, and a lot of people try to through escape, but if you could, and somebody fell down in front of you, you'd say, karma. There'd be no psychological person there. Let me help you. The predicament is that if you read the newspapers, the magazines, the books about the reality we're living in, primarily, they are based on treating as real the sensory material world. And treating you as a separate and discrete unit. And most of the myths that Joseph Campbell enunciates and that we deal with about us really focus around our individuality. When you experience the plane of reality where everything is interdependent, it includes you. You're part of it all. If you flip the dial and go to another plane of reality, you see that behind all of the forms, which are like cloud patterns, there's only one of it. There's one stuff. There's one stuff that keeps going into these incredible patterns, which are mainly space, by the way. And just beyond that, or within that, or around that, is what? The formless? Nirvana, emptiness, the unmanifest, the source, the unspeakable, the unnameable. It's beyond even the one, the concept of one. Now, many of you have gone in and out of these planes of consciousness. You may have done it just in between your dream state and your waking state. You may have done it through a devotional practice. You may have had it happen through trauma in your life, through some terrible crisis, a near-death experience it could have happened through. It could happen through where you pitch yourself against the edge of the forces of the universe, like surfing or doing something where you're right at the edge of your, and it takes you out of your mind. It takes you out of the thinking, sensing domain where this physical, psychological, social, material plane is real, and it flips you into other dimensions where you experience other planes of reality. The way we short shrift ourselves is by limiting ourselves so stringently to what my father would say, Rich, come down to reality. You know, how are you going to earn a living? I'd come back just having been with God, and he'd say, how are you going to earn a living? I'm doing it right this minute. The way we short shrift ourselves is by not acknowledging that these other planes of consciousness are equally real. They're equally real. And that certain planes of these consciousness we know primarily through our intuitive hearts, where we are part of everything. And what we're facing at the moment is that the limits we've imposed upon our definitions of reality are now dysfunctional to the predicament we find ourselves in, because we have got to recognize that we are interdependent with the earth and all the species. We have to recognize that we are interdependent with other human beings in all kinds of conditions around the world, because our technology demands it. We have to find a way to be in the world fully and simultaneously not be trapped by it. We have the opportunity to acknowledge that we are both separate entities and not separate entities. That we are both unique and part of one thing. And it is that balance or tension about reality that changes the nature of the game.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at Ramdas.org. We can then continue to share what Ramdas has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.